Welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt, and this is another podcast for Beyond the Mekong, as broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today is Matt Driscoll. Matt is the editor of Asia Aviation. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
What is the state of aviation in Southeast Asia and beyond, actually? It's the economies, the politics, everything's had a wild ride over the last 10, 20 years. But aviation, as I understand it, it's not in too bad shape.
Asian Aviation, which is the name of the magazine, actually, is doing very well. We came out of COVID in good shape. There was a lot of what they called revenge travel back then.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody hadn't been able to travel for 2 years. Singapore was locked down, Cambodia, you know, everything was locked down. So you had this huge immediate spike in travel. It's kind of come back now, back down to what you would call a normal level. It's still growing around the region. Southeast Asia, for sure, is growing. You see that illustrated by a lot of the low-cost airlines. AirAsia is still doing very well. Scoot in Singapore. We had a couple of problems in Australia, which is not Southeast Asia, but we always had some problems down there. But no, it's doing very well. People are investing in airports here in Cambodia. We just opened a new airport, Techo. I was out there with my son, taking him back to university. And it's a nice airport. It looks nice. I think they've got some teething pains that they need to work on. But overall, the industry is doing well. There are a few problems.
Right. With the airports, seeing as you raised the subject, they are colossal compared to the numbers, the planes that come in here. Are they warranted?
People are betting, Cambodia, for example, is betting on growth. They plan to see, they think they will see, tourism, especially, really growing. The Chinese market has not flooded back into Cambodia like it was before.
Sure.
When I went to Angkor Wat in 2019, just before everything got shut down, it was Chinese, Russians, and everybody else, huge tour groups of Chinese. They haven't materialized so much, although they're coming back. So you saw the new airport in Siem Reap that opened up. People are really building. Vietnam is expanding its airports.
There's a new airport plan there for Saigon, as I understand it.
Yeah. And so they're betting on future growth, and especially with tourism, and then also for business as well, business travelers as well.
I think you were saying the other day that that new airport here in Phnom Penh, that 30 years from now, they'll be they'll be thanking the people who built it.
And again, you know, these airports, they take a long time to build. They cost billions of dollars. This one, I think, was somewhere between $5 and $6 billion, maybe more. So the infrastructure, it's not cheap to build a proper modern airport with all the new safety features, with all the electronics and all of those kinds of things. And they take a long time to build, and their service life is going to be a long time in coming as well. Me personally, you know, we saw in Asia proper, Hong Kong with its new airport. I was one of the last people, to fly into the old Kai Tak, which I loved, when you're flying in over, Kowloon side. But I was one of the first people that came in on one of the last planes into Kai Tak. Then Hong Kong really was a model for how to do it, because they set up the airport express train. Cambodia might have missed the mark a little bit by not setting up a train from the middle of town out to the airport itself. They're thinking about that. They probably should have built that into the project at the first, but these things happen.
Right. Yeah, I remember the Kai Tak days well. Those last flights out. I'll give you a little certificate. We don't read a lot of the stories that we read 10 years ago or 20 years ago. By that, I mean airlines in trouble. Airlines, every week there was an airline being set up. Another month later, an airline was closing down. Is there a lot more stability in the airline industry? Is it coming from the private sector, or is it also, airlines are they're a part of national prestige? The governments want, like, so for Vietnamese, for example, the amount of money that was tipped into Vietnam Airlines to make it codeshare friendly, say with British Airways and Qantas, these types of things. It seems to have stabilized a lot more over the years, despite the numbers of travelers being not what they were.
Listen, this might seem like a long answer, but there's a couple of parts to that answer. There's an old saying, how to become a millionaire. You start with $1 billion and you invest in an airline. And that's how you become a millionaire. There's also, I forget, I was at a trade show one time and I forget who said this, but the guy was up giving a speech or something in a presentation. And he said, airlines are a hamburger and a Coke away from losing money on a per passenger, per flight basis.
Right.
So, and there's, even though the amount of travel post-COVID has gone way up and, or basically it's stabilized now, but even with that resurgent travel, airlines are still, the profit margins are incredibly thin. And the hamburger and Coke illustration is actually pretty good, because that's why you see all these airlines trying to charge extra for bags. That's why you see them in economy, especially they're going to charge you for drinks and things like that, because they've got to make the money up somewhere.
Sure.
Second problem facing the airlines right now is costs. You see this with air navigation providers raising prices, airports raising landing fees, restricting the slots that are available. This is a problem in Australia, for example. So you have airport charges that airlines have to pay and all of that. Fuel is probably, it's probably 33% of, it's one of the biggest costs combined. I think it's fuel and then staff and things like that. And also acutely right now, you're seeing a problem with engine availability. And this is a problem in New Zealand. It's a problem for Air New Zealand.
Issues with Pratt.
The Pratt & Whitney, Rolls-Royce, these engines, they are marvels of modern engineering. I mean, they really are. When you think about it, you got a two-engine plane, it's taking 500, not 500, but, a wide-body jet, two engines, putting out enough thrust to take 300 people on a 12, 14-hour, 15-hour flight. So the engineering that goes into them is absolutely, it's crazy, the engineering. And in some cases, you might say it's over-engineered. For example, the Pratt & Whitney GTF engine, great engine when it works. The problem is some of the fan blades don't agree with hot and high climates, which you would see in the Middle East, or you would see in, mountainous terrain, things like that. And so they're having to go through this big program of maintenance, repair, and overhaul on these engines. And so it's affected Air New Zealand. It's affected a lot of other, Cebu Pacific in the Philippines. They're having a problem. So the airlines can't expand as much as they want or as fast as they want because they got the plane. They just don't have the engines for the plane because the engines are having to spend more time in the shops. Problem facing airlines. Another one is shop visits. We saw a tremendous number of people in the MRO industry, maintenance, repair, and overhaul, leave the industry during COVID. So you got all this institutional knowledge that went out the door. A guy that was there or a lady that was there for 20 years or 30 years, and you got to bring someone in, and it takes time to train those people and get them fully up to speed on things. So lack of engines, MRO problems, slot availability, being able to get the slots you want into a certain airport at a certain time. Everybody wants to leave in the morning and arrive in the afternoon, but it doesn't always work that way.
Right.
So you may not have the slot available until midnight or 2 in the morning, and you have to configure your schedules for all that.
Okay. There was a lot of money tipped into the airlines to, I guess, ensure their viability towards the end of COVID and after COVID. It was all part of the kind of the big spend, which we're paying for now in terms of how much money is going around in the system, I guess. But I think what you're saying is demand is there, but there are still these issues. Do people spend wisely in terms of the airlines post-COVID, then there are issues with Qantas. Singapore Airlines was, I think, widely praised for the way they handled the pandemic. But how did the others fare?
Well, I think, and this goes back to your point earlier about national prestige for the airlines and things like that. Hong Kong put a bunch of money into Cathay Pacific. Singapore, of course, supported Singapore Air. And you look at the money that was spent by the Middle East Airlines as well. Qatar actually operated pretty well during COVID, but they got state funding as well. And again, it goes back to, as you were talking about, national prestige. You know, I'm in the, I cover the industry. Do I think they spent wisely? Yes, because when you look at what could have happened, I mean, it was bad enough what did happen,
but
with people laid off, people got fired, et cetera. So that was bad enough. But if an airline on the scale of Singapore Airlines, for example, had to go into receivership, that would have been a huge shock, not just to the business community, not just financially, but to the markets in Singapore, and to restart some an airline like that out of receivership or bankruptcy, as we call it in America, it would be really hard. So do I think they spent wisely? I think it was something that they had to do. And if they hadn't done it, then it would have been really bad news, not just for the airlines, not just for the constituencies, Hong Kong, Singapore, et cetera. But it would have been for the industry overall and for the traveling public, because who's going to step in and fill that void?
Well, actually, that leads into my next question. Where is the industry going in the sense that that we have the national airlines, big privately owned airline stock market? This is a lot of boutique and the cheaper end of the market. It's yet, I think it's come from kind of nowhere over the last few years, and it's proving itself quite popular. Well, in terms of the market, where is it going over the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years?
Well, it says you mentioned Vietjet. They've got something going on in London, some financial things that I'm not sure about. I need to check on that story. But they're also contemplating a U.S. listing. We just ran a story today, as a matter of fact. The chairman of the airline, I think it's Vietnam's richest woman, was in New York. They're talking about flying to the U.S. as well. And what you're seeing is with the industry in general here in Southeast Asia and Asia Pacific more widely and across the U.S., you're seeing it sort of a two-tier system where you have what we call the legacy carriers. So with Singapore Airlines, you know, the full fare carrier, where you've got a proper business class and some planes, you still get a first class. And then you have the low-cost carriers like Vietjet, AirAsia, Scoot, et cetera. So you're kind of seeing that. And also a lot of the airline, AirAsia might be an outlier in this respect, but a lot of airlines started, you know, they might have had actually three levels of planes. And so now it's basically legacy carrier and low-cost carrier.
Right.
And that's basically it.
Nothing in between.
Not anything really in between. And so I like flying business class when I can afford it. And I'm going to fly Singapore Airlines whenever I can fly them, because I love the service. I think it's probably Singapore and Qatar always compete for the number one airline
Right.
designation in the world. And so I know what the product is and I love it. I don't like low-cost carriers. That's my personal thing. If I was a 22-year-old backpacker, you know,
Sure.
I would tell you, I would take the $200 flight to Nepal or wherever, or to Bali, and take my backpack. I got my $200 seat, and I'm happy because I flew from wherever, and it didn't cost me that much. So, you know, they've got that market pretty well covered, but that's not for me. I'm older now. I like my comfort a little bit.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
Yeah.
And you get on a Singapore Airlines flight, the minute you sit down, it's like, what is happening with the other airlines?
No, and that's true. I mean, there was one airline I flew. I'll save them some embarrassment, but I flew to KL. You can probably guess who it was. And I had such a bad experience. I rented a car and a driver and hired a driver driving back to Singapore. I said, I'm not flying them ever again. And I've never flown them again. I will not fly them again. Not because they're unsafe, pretty much as safe as any other airline out there. But just because the service was so bad. And we can talk about service as well, because another, when you talk about where the industry is going, it's automation. I just did an interview with a guy who's president for Asia Pacific of this organization called CETA, which is kind of this conglomeration of airports around the world. And they deal with technology for airports. So every time you go to the bag drop and you've got to do your own ticket,
Right.
do your own bag tag, which I hate, actually. I hate doing that. But you can't avoid it. So CETA is responsible for a lot of that. And at TECO here in Cambodia, automation at airports, even in the planes to a certain extent. I was at a lounge a long time ago, and they had a robot going around with the tray for your used dishes and stuff. And, that's all great, but they say, oh, it's more efficient and we're training people to do other jobs. Well, not really. They're using automation as a way to cut jobs,
Sure.
which I don't like.
It is an experience. I think the travel over the last 12 months around Southeast Asia, the passports now all recognize flight streaming. I'm amazed at how quickly you can get out of the airport. It's terrific. But and getting out is a different experience to getting in. And when you're going in and you're kind of grumpy. It's in the morning. You finally get to the airport and you're just confronted by all these machines. One person who's a little bit overwrought because there are all these people trying to figure out what button do I push. It has changed enormously. Yeah, I guess it is all about the money.
Well, it's about the money, but all, but, you know, it's kind of interesting to me. And again, I interviewed the president for APAC, Sumesh Patel, very nice guy. And I always tease him a little bit. Automation is becoming to the point where we check our own bags. We order our meals ahead of time. We do this, we do that. It's getting to the point where the passenger does everything except fly the plane.
Right.
And he laughed.
Yeah, well, they might.
He's a great guy. And he laughed about it. But also, it's getting to the point when you talk about the passport
Right.
recognition, biometrics is becoming a huge deal. And I wish that, and there are standards in place for data security and things like that, which I wish they had during COVID, because
Sure.
we had all these competing health passes. IANA had one, the big industry body for airlines, all these different organizations.
Four apps on your phone that you had to clear and check in.
Which you didn't know about. And
Yes.
I was teasing Sumesh again when I was talking to him. And I said, well, you remember that movie Minority Report with Tom Cruise? And he gets his eyes switched out because when you walk into a shopping mall, they have these biometric readers and it sees your eye and says, oh, welcome back, Mr. Driscoll. How did you like those trousers from the Gap that you bought the other day? And it remembers you. And, back when the movie came out, people thought, oh, well, that's interesting. And we're quickly getting to that point at the airport where you'll still have a passport, but you may not need it so much,
Right.
or you may need it once. And then when you get to the gate, for example, and they check your passport again, it might be another gate, like going through immigration or something, where it just looks at your face and scans everything and you go right through. So is that good or is it bad? It's good in a certain respect, for what they call the passenger experience, because you don't have to mess around with another gate agent and who can't see something, and then they gotta, so the automation in that respect might be good, but at the same time, and again, people call me old-fashioned. I like the personal touch. I like the human touch.
Sure.
When I get to the gate, I like to see if I can get another upgrade.
And you're an experienced traveler, you know what you're doing, and there's an awful lot of people who aren't.
Well,
And always kind of tuning, you've got old people, years traveling off to trying to make sense of it all to get through.
My father, I mean, before he passed away, I mean, he never sent an email in his entire life.
Right.
Never had a computer, didn't have email, didn't have anything.
Mm.
And he had an assistant who did all that for him. And, you know, he would be one of those that would not be able to cope with everything that a modern traveler has to cope with in terms of the technology, QR codes. I mean, he got his first smartphone maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that. I can't remember. And before, he had one of those old fashioned little flip phones.
Yep.
Because all he did was make calls. He didn't text. He knew how to, you know, call my number, but that was
right.
Like him, yeah. He wouldn't be able to travel in today's planes.
This seems a little math, to be honest, given there's a big chunk of the market with my industry.
Oh, they're a huge part of the market. The over 50 market, yeah, they've got money and they want to spend and they want to travel.
Right.
They're retired and
yeah.
They want to go, you know, to places they've never been.
I was going to say long haul market shaping up. I kind of mean the extreme end of long haul. Like with Australia, you've got direct flights to London, non-stop, 32 hours or something.
Not quite 32 hours.
It's a long time to be on a plane. I've seen the new layouts they have for the planes. Obviously, costs are trying to bypass Asia as a stop-off destination. How viable is this? Is it really going to take off? So like Sydney, New York, or Melbourne, London, and often they're going via Perth to fly across the Indian Ocean. That sort of seems to be where it started. But is this going to reshape the industry, or is it peculiar because Australia was so far away?
Well, you'll remember Qantas, for example, is Project Sunrise.
Right.
And this was an Alan Joyce thing. Before he left the airline, you know, it's already, for example, I went home in July this year to the U.S. and where I live in the U.S., right in the middle of the country. So it's 24 hours just on the plane. And normally I fly I go to the Middle East. I like Qatar. It's a good airline. So I would fly from Phnom Penh, Singapore, Doha to Dallas, and then Dallas to my home in Oklahoma City. In all, it's about 48 hours travel, really, when you take layovers, plane is late, et cetera, et cetera. I personally would not want to be, God forbid, in coach or economy. I would not want to be on a plane for 20 plus hours. Under any circumstances, you need to be able to get off, go to a proper bathroom, sit down, have a proper meal somewhere. You know, it's bad enough. You know, people talk about cattle class or things like that. I personally would not fly on one of those flights for 20 plus hours. I just wouldn't do it. And I honestly don't believe, given the state of play right now, and actually what is not just Qantas, but there's a Chinese airline, I think it was China Southern, I have to double check, that they're talking about flying down to South America nonstop, which would be something like 20 plus, you know, 22
to 23.
And number one, there's too many things that can go wrong. And I don't mean just safety of the plane. I mean, passenger gets a heart attack. They get a blood clot.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden you got a vector into somewhere in South America and you're
right.
What else? And I don't think that people are going to do that. And I don't think the industry currently is configured to where that's going to make money. And the airline industry, any business, they're not. You know, they talk about, we're here to serve the people. No, they're not. They're there to create value for their shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
And an airline is no different from a bank or anyone else. They've got to create value for their shareholders. And if you're not making money on that flight, that's why they turn them around so quickly on the ground, because every minute that plane sits on the ground, it's not making money. That's why they don't pay flight attendants until they close the door.
Right.
Yeah. Flight attendant, when they're at the airport and they're getting briefed,
yep,
they're not getting paid. They don't get paid till they close the door and they get in the air. If you look at most flight attendant contracts, mm-hmm. they don't get paid for time on the ground. It's when they close the door, then they're on the clock. But up in
touch,
it is hard.
So pilots?
I have to double check. Depends on the union contract. Depends on the union contract. You know, I just honestly, I don't think that airlines are configured properly now to support. I just don't think they're going to make money.
Okay. In terms of destinations, what's hot, what's not? You know, the market is still kind of evaluating where to go in a post-COVID world. I mean, COVID started 5 years ago, but where we are in Phnom Penh, Angkor Wat up north was, you know, year after year, world's number one tourist destination. I think a lot of that's changed. I also think the what's in the mindset of travelers, and particularly the kids these days, it's changed as well. What was exotic 20, 30 years ago may no longer be the same. What's hot, what's not?
Well, one place I would not go to is Bali, for example, because it's just, it's completely overrun with tourists now.
Yeah.
And it's creating lots of problems.
Interesting you should say that. I was in Bali a month ago, traveling to Bali in the 1980s. So got a pretty good idea what it was like. Been going ever since. The traffic was absolutely horrendous. We were staying in Kangju, which is 21 kilometers from the airport, 2.5 to 3 hours to get there. And the funny thing was, sailed out of the airport, got through within a few minutes. Not a problem. It was great. The airport was great. But getting a ride, and not only was it ridiculously expensive, but I'm like, why is it so expensive? Oh, it's peak hour. It's 2:15 in the afternoon. That's not peak hour. But yeah, I was absolutely amazed by the trip.
No, it's, yeah, Bali's, I wouldn't go to Bali. Vietnam is hot.
Yeah.
Their tourism is up. Surprisingly, I mean, you talked about Angkor Wat and Siem Reap. The Chinese are starting to come back this year.
Okay.
So Siem Reap, and I love Siem Reap. I love Angkor Wat. I mean, to me, I've never been to Egypt and never seen the pyramids.
Right.
But Angkor tourism is coming back. It's still got a long way to go to get back to pre-COVID.
And of course, we don't even dwell on it. The moment there is the border conflict with
I just think any place that's overdone, I don't like. I don't want to go with a bunch of crowds and all this.
It goes back to the problem with the Asian cities in that there's that it's a derogatory term where it's just another Asian city, and there's a lot of truth to that. You know, Hong Kong, Bangkok, Singapore, I mean, well, okay, it's another more skyscrapers, more traffic, more people, but what attracted people to these destinations just no longer exists, and they're not true.
Well, Singapore, for example, incredibly expensive place to go to. I lived there for a long time. Hong Kong has changed. You and I met in Hong Kong. Go foreign correspondents.
Yeah, Matt is the former president of the FCC HK.
But Hong Kong has changed politically. So a lot of people, you know, it wasn't the way it was in the late 90s when I first came there. So that's changed, and that affects the tourism as well. Although people still go there, people are still doing business there. So it's doing okay. But I think Japan is starting to see a lot more tourists,
right?
Which they have a love-hate relationship with tourists. Little anecdote, there's a 7-Eleven that is here, and then Mount Fuji is in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And they got tired of these crowds of people taking pictures and selfies that had the 7-Eleven in there with Mount Fuji.
Right.
So they said no more pictures. They outlawed it and they couldn't do it.
That's
it. They were having so many tourists.
Yeah.
But Japan's tourism is coming back. You're seeing it in Australia to a certain extent. But I think here in Southeast Asia, places in Malaysia, but again, Cambodia, Vietnam, Malaysia to a certain extent, Laos even,
right,
to a certain extent, although they've got to bring up their infrastructure. They got a long way to go to even to match Cambodia's tourism infrastructure.
Yep. Okay. Matt, terrific chat. we're running out of time. But so all in all, the airline industry, it's in pretty good shape. And Vietnam, for what Bali is in.
Bali's up.
Sorry, Bali.
It's in good shape. It's got some problems, like any business. If they can sort out the engines. One thing we didn't talk about, and I'll just mention this quickly, sustainable aviation fuel. You see a lot of, we talk about everybody going green, but the current person in the White House doesn't believe in climate change or anything like that. The airline industry is trying to do something. The problem is SAF, as they call it, sustainable aviation fuel, twice as much or three times as much as regular fuel. And as long as the airlines have such thin margins, they're not going to pay for SAF. And the industry wants to be net zero by 2050. I don't think it's going to happen.
On that note, Matthew Driscoll, thank you very much.